This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with our own Michael Stephen Smith about his newly released book, Lawyers for the Left.
The subtitle is In the Courts, In the Streets, and On the Air. The book came in part out of this radio show. Give a listen and get the book.
Climate activist had a rare victory using the necessity defense in a Washington state appeals court.
The necessity defense is that you can commit a crime to prevent a larger crime. And in this case, the largest crime you could imagine. Climate destruction, the destruction of humanity. How do we fight it?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Lawyers for the Left, In the Courts, In the Streets, and On the Air, is the title of the just-published book by our own Michael Stephen Smith. It profiles some of the nation's most effective agents of social change. Michael discusses how he came to write this book and previews several of the movement lawyers profiled therein. As Chris Hedges says, quote, "The lawyers in this book valiantly fought the erosion of justice and assault on the court system." Michael, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, and welcome, Heidi. I'm glad to be here with you to talk about lawyers for the left.
Michael, tell us about the origins of this new book.
Lawyers for the Left came out of our radio show, Law and Disorder, which in turn came out of 9/11, because as you know, Heidi, you've been up to visit me. At that time, I lived right across the street from the Twin Towers. In fact, had the building fallen over sideways instead of on itself, it would have fallen on me. I was up there with my wife and my 16-pound cat, Mo, and my talking parrot, Charlie Parker. When the planes hit the World Trade Center, the neighborhood turned black. Then the second building came down and turned black again. We were totally covered with about 4 inches of toxic dust, and we had no telephone or water or lights, nothing. The cops told everybody in the building to evacuate, and we weren't very portable with the animals, so we stayed there overnight. But the next day, they told us we had to get out. So we left Mo because he was too heavy to carry, and we took Charlie, put him in his traveling cage, and we started walking up to the village to stay with Michael Ratner and Karen Minucci in their home up there. And on the way, Charlie kept telling everybody we encountered, "It's okay, it's okay." But it wasn't okay. That's when we got the idea to start our radio show. Law and Disorder was a proposition that we made to WBAI almost 15 years ago. They put us on every other week, and then they put us on every week. And by the time Michael passed away 3 years ago, we had 60 stations listening to us, and now we have 120. So Colin Robinson, the co-publisher of OR Books, said, "You know, these interviews that you've done with these significant lawyers are really terrific. Why don't you transcribe and edit them, and we'll publish them?" And that was the origin of the book. You and I and Michael interviewed these wonderful people. We've got 23 chapters in the book. Half of it are the interviews that we did. The other half are articles that I wrote about various lawyers like Bill Kunstler, Conrad Lynn, Bruce Wright, Haywood Burns, significant figures in American social history. So that's where the book came from, and it's just came out. People can get it at OR Books, orbooks.com, and order it directly. I've been on a little bit of a speaking tour, so this was not the hardest gig I've ever gotten, and I'm glad to be here with you to talk about it.
Michael, what is the underlying theme to the book?
Corporate capitalism is increasingly not compatible with democracy. That's what we think. That's what a number of the lawyers that we profile in the book articulate. I think that would be the underlying theme.
Michael, what is the law?
Well, liberals think the law is a system of rules and regulations so that people can resolve disputes between themselves or between themselves and the government, and any mistakes that are made can be corrected. That's the law. But Bill Kunstler had a different definition of the law, which I think is a much wiser one. Bill said that the law is, in fundamental essence, nothing more than a method of control created by a socioeconomic system determined at all costs to perpetuate itself by all means necessary for as long as possible. Well, I think that what Michael Tiger said about Bill Kunstler's quote, Michael said, well, that's half right, but if you're batting 500, you can still lead the league. And Michael added something that I'm sure Bill would agree with, and that's that you can't just rule by repression. You can't have six cops on every street corner. I mean, you could, but it's a hard, expensive way to rule.
And not effective, I might add.
And not effective. And so they rule in a different way, a much more subtle way. They rule by myths. There's a mythology that we live in a democracy. There's a mythology that we have a marketplace of ideas. We're all created equal, you know, with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, we're not all created equal. My son is not equal to Donald Trump's sons. And there is no equal opportunity. They say there is, but there's not. But it's those myths that perpetuate this increasingly unfair and scary society.
Your book contains individuals who we here on Law and Disorder would really call luminaries. Let's start with Lynn Stewart.
A courageous luminary. We interviewed her many times, and we print in the book one of the interviews. You know, as you know, Lynn represented the famous blind sheik in a case in the mid-90s. And after he was framed up and convicted and sent to a maxi prison in Minnesota, she went out to visit him. And her purpose in visiting him was to then issue a press release to try to keep his name in front of the public. And she did that, and nothing happened. She violated a rule. It was a slap-on-the-wrist rule. And 2 years later, after 9/11, and after Bush got elected, Ashcroft, John Ashcroft, Bush's attorney general, was looking to make an example out of an attorney and scare them from representing anybody accused of terrorism. So they went back, and they found what Lynn Stewart had done when she issued that press release, and they indicted her for materially giving assistance to terrorism. What was the material assistance? A press release. And they tried her downtown, a couple blocks from 9/11. They put big 8-by-10-foot photographs of Osama bin Laden on the walls. They scared the jury to death. The jury came back with a guilty verdict. Well, the judge was not unsympathetic to Lynn Stewart, and he sentenced her to 28 months in prison. Now, here's a woman who had survived cancer, and 28 months in prison wasn't going to do her any good, but he could have sentenced her to like 30 years. Well, when Bush's cousin, Judge Walker, who sits on the appellate court, saw Lynn Stewart on television, this is what happened. Lynn went on Democracy Now, and Amy Goodman asked her, Lynn, if you had it to do all over again, would you do it? And Lynn said, yes, I think I would. The judge was enraged. He directed the trial judge, Codal, to resentence her, which you can do in the federal system. And Codal sentenced her to 10 years in prison. Now, here's a 65-year-old grandmother with cancer in remission, and they sent her to a prison in Texas. She was on death's door. They let her out to allow her to die at home, and she didn't die on him. She lived for another couple of years, and she continued to talk publicly about what had happened to her and what had happened to the decline of democracy in the country, a real, true profile in courage.
Michael, you referenced Bruce Wright a few minutes ago. Who was he? And talk a bit about him.
Bruce was a great African-American judge from Harlem. He had been in the Second World War, and he had been wounded. He got a medal. He was coming back home, and white racist officer looked at him and said, I didn't know they allowed niggers to fight. So he thought, this is what Bruce writes about. This is a quote from his book. So Bruce thought, what am I going back to that country for? And he stayed in Paris. He came back 16 months later, and practiced law. He represented some of the great bebop musicians, among other things. And in the 70s, when Mayor Lindsay, who was a classy guy, was looking to appoint judges, he called Bruce downtown, and he said, "I'd like you to be a judge." And Bruce said, "Well, I'd like to be a judge too, but I don't think I can afford it." And Mayor Lindsay said, "No, I'm not asking for a contribution. I want you to be a judge." So Bruce took the bench. He was a criminal court judge for many years. The thing that got him in trouble was when he gave bail to a black man accused of killing a cop. Well, the Policeman's Benevolent Association went crazy. And I remember the demonstrations that we had in front of the municipal building in support of Bruce Wright. Nonetheless, he was relieved of his job on the bench.
And didn't the police have a nickname for him, Michael? Let him loose, Bruce?
Turn him loose, Bruce.
Turn
that was
loose,
the headline
Bruce.
On the Daily News. Turn him loose, Bruce. Well, Bruce turned around and ran for judge up in Harlem, got elected. He was overwhelmingly popular with the citizens of Harlem, as well as the attorneys. I appeared before him a number of times. He was intelligent and polite and kind to attorneys. He was a joy. We all thought that. He was so popular in the city that his favorite encomium, he relates in the book, is he was riding his bike down 125th Street and got knocked off, and he was laying there in the roadbed, seriously injured, and a fellow came up and looked down at him and said, "Oh, S-H-I, it's the judge." So that's one of the profiles in Lawyers for the Left, Bruce Wright.
Talking about someone who is still with us and very active in Washington, D.C., is Mara Verheiden Hilliard, another frequent guest on Law and Disorder.
Well, I hope that we can play a clip from our interview with her. She won two significant cases that you know a lot about, Heidi, against the police for disrupting and busting up mass demonstrations, both here in New York City and in Washington, D.C. And in Washington, she got new rules written, so they can't do that anymore. And her thought was, we got to keep the movement in the streets. Social change comes from below. And I take cases not just because they're First Amendment cases, but because they're social change cases. I take cases to empower the movement.
We call her the queen of protest defense. Michael, let's play a clip from one of our interviews with Mara.
Good idea.
All social change, all historical change in the United States that has made a difference for people has come from below. It has come from popular movements and popular struggle, not because the politicians decide to give people rights, but because there is that feeling that the people are demanding them and that they are going to force it to happen. So that at the end of the day, we don't see the issue being just, do we get a judge on the bench to agree with us, and that's it. It's also making sure that there is space for people to be able to express themselves. So in that way, we turn to our clients again and again to make sure that we are working both with our clients and with community organizations in service of their ultimate struggles.
And in fact, you're reminding me of Arthur Kanoy, longtime guild member who was a sort of a hero of many guild members.
Of many of us.
And in fact, that's what Arthur told legions of law students and young lawyers, is that you have to listen to the people you're serving. We take their message from them. And so often traditional attorneys will advise clients in a certain way. But I think that you and Carl and the partnership really are fabulous listeners.
Oh, thank you.
And knowing that these cases do take, as you say, upwards of 10 years and even more, I would suppose that many attorneys might be tempted to take shortcuts. Can you give some pointers for how you hang in there for the long haul in this kind of case?
Well, first of all, I have to say that we have fabulous plaintiffs and clients. We are so honored to be able to work with people who are absolutely committed to the underlying issues, the issues that they went on the streets for to begin with, and then the issues that arise in the context of litigation. So that in these cases, for example, these two long-running mass arrest cases that we've been litigating, one since 2000, one since 2002, that we've recently settled in the past year, these cases, our clients said to us whenever we communicated with them that their ultimate goal was to make sure that what happened to them never happened to anyone else. In both these cases, there's more than 1,000 people, class members, that we're representing who were engaged in peaceful protests in Washington, D.C., and the police came in and surrounded them and swept people off the streets, took parents and their children, separating them, took protesters, took bystanders, tourists, held them on buses in punitive, abusive conditions with their hands tied up behind them, and then took them to like a police gym floor where they were hogtied and people were tied up wrist to ankle in stress and duress positions for more than 24 hours, unable to extend their backs.
Oh.
And the sadism and cruelty of this is, you know, extreme, coming from the police department and ratified by the municipality. But all of our clients wanted to fight these cases out to make sure that we could change the landscape in D.C. And that's what we set out to do, and that's what the fight goes on so long for. Because I think that, you know, the municipalities, the governments, they want these cases to go on as long as possible. They want to fight a war of attrition because they want plaintiffs to feel like they have to take toothless settlements and walk away with, you know, little that they've accomplished. And they want to make it hard for them to find attorneys who are willing to stay and fight for the decade that it takes. And we were willing to do that. Our clients are willing to do that. And so, for example, in D.C., it has changed here. I mean, not to say that we don't think, you know, with an upsurge of social justice movement, the police won't violate the law again in some way, and we'll be in court that day. But the fact is, right now, the law has changed in D.C. We have training in place. We've changed the way the police operate. They can't use these tactics. These specific tactics that we took apart piece by piece have been removed from the arsenal of the police department in D.C.
Mara, can you talk specifically about the changes, and I believe the city council was involved in this process, in 2004, I think, to the manual that the police use for how they treat demonstrators?
Well, there were two elements of change. In a number of our cases, we've had more than those two mass arrest cases, and in the series of cases we've brought over the past decade, we have, as part of equitable relief in our cases, gotten changes in the police mass demonstration manual and their training programs, their requirements. But as well, there was a change in the law, which goes beyond the manual, which in 2004 and took effect in 2005, which is the First Amendment Rights and Police Standards Act. And that law specifically actually tracked the demands we were making in our cases so that, for example, the police can't just throw up these pop-up police lines and surround demonstrators and stop a demonstration, not allow people to leave, arrest them. They can't use that trap and detain, trap and arrest tactic. They can't hold people for long periods of time. If people are arrested in D.C. for, you know, basic nonviolent offenses in the context of First Amendment activity, they have to be let out 4 hours now if they're arrested by the D.C. police. They cannot use that wrist-to-ankle handcuffing mechanism against people anymore. And there are a number of other provisions like that. The police have to have their badges plainly available and visible. They can't come out in riot gear to First Amendment assemblies, which, you know, make assemblies look like they're criminal activity when, in fact, it's cherished free speech activity.
That was Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. Speaking of another creative and bold person, Conrad Lynn brought a lawsuit in 1947 challenging segregation in the U.S. Army. Talk about his strategy.
That was my typo. I think it was 1943. I'm sure it comes as a surprise to many of our listeners that the U.S. Army was segregated, that the war against racist Hitler was fought by a segregated racist army. Conrad Lynn was bold and creative and brought a lawsuit on behalf of his brother, who became a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, on behalf of his brother to desegregate the Army. They lost that suit. But when Truman became president, the United States looked so bad in the eyes of the world as such a racist country that they had to do some desegregation in a hurry. They desegregated the Army, and as you know, in 1954, they made a pitiful attempt to desegregate schools. If it's okay, I wanted to read something that I wrote about Conrad Lynn.
Of course. Read away.
Cancer claimed Conrad Lynn, who passed away in his bungalow home in rural Rockland County, north of New York City. He was 87 years old and had been an extraordinary movement lawyer, political thinker, and activist since he joined the Young Communist League as a student at Syracuse University in 1928. He intended to enter the church, but became a minister with a different mission. "Understand this about my father," his son Alexander said as he memorialized him. "He was a communist. His communism was like that of the early Christian church in that it stemmed from human beings having a sense of responsibility for one another. Conrad had been both a founder of the National Lawyers Guild and the National Conference of Black Lawyers. Several hundred friends, fellow lawyers, judges, family members, and comrades joined him in a magnificent memorial meeting at City College in New York City. Judge Bruce Wright said that he was a one-man civil rights movement long before it became popular, long before others joined in. Although he was of small stature, Conrad had the heart of a lion. He laughed heartily with eyes smiling behind thick glasses, and he laughed a lot. Though only 5'4" tall, Conrad had muscled large athletic legs. Until nearly the end, he sprinted for exercise rather than jogging, and he insisted on cutting his own firewood, his motto being, "A man who chops his own wood is warmed twice by the fire." He read widely and all the time. Conversation with Conrad was an event, as his family and friends recalled. He laced his observations with quotes from Kipling and Longfellow, C.L.R. James and Frantz Fanon, and of course the Bible. Speaking of his accomplishments, Heywood Burns recalled that the litany goes back 6 decades. He recounted some of Conrad's battles. In 1943, on behalf of his brother Samuel, Conrad brought the first suit to desegregate the U.S. Army. At that time, black people were consigned to menial jobs, like Conrad, who spent weeks shoveling out the latrine. And just let me conclude with one of his famous cases, the Kissing case. Conrad was the chief lawyer in the infamous 1958 Kissing case, which became an international scandal. 2 Monroe County, North Carolina, African-American children, ages 8 and 10, were convicted and imprisoned for being kissed on the cheek by a white child. Monroe County was and is controlled by the Jesse Helms family. The children were terrorized and scarred for life. Conrad took an appeal of their case, which was lost. It was only with the intervention of Eleanor Roosevelt, who cried when Conrad told her what had happened, that the children were freed.
Michael, you write also about Leonard Boudin's 15-year-old litigation against the FBI to legalize being a socialist. Talk about that.
And being in a socialist party. The FBI, under the COINTEL program, maintained the position, which it never gave up, maintained the position that they could spy on and disrupt and destroy a socialist organization. And Leonard Boudin, who was the great constitutional litigator of his time, brought a case, the litigation lasted 15 years, on behalf of the Socialist Workers' Party, which was a socialist party of about 3,000 people. He brought the case against the FBI to get an injunction against what the FBI was doing. 10 million pages were produced by the government during the 8-year discovery process. The judge told Leonard, "Mr. Boudin, you're not going to believe what's in these papers." What was in the papers? Well, it showed that the FBI had infiltrated the organization and had inserted 300 informers as members. It used 1,300 spies to report on them. It had FBI agents visit their landlords to get them evicted, visit their employers to get them fired. It bugged their rooms. It burglarized their office many times. It did everything they could to destroy them. It tried to get internal dissent stirred up. It tried to get their reputation tarnished with other movement groups. And it took this magnificent lawsuit that Leonard Boudin started and concluded in the middle 80s, concluded with an injunction against the FBI that they could never do this again and a $268,000 judgment against them. Why is this important? Well, obviously, half the country now would prefer socialism to capitalism, particularly amongst young people. People are identifying with socialism. They're joining socialist organizations. And these organizations are legal, and we would have to be naive to think that the FBI isn't going to do again what it did back then. We've got the law on our side, and we should use it.
Michael, I think that your book, Lawyers for the Left, would be an important addition to a constitutional law course curriculum. With that in mind, what challenges do you see facing the movement and its attorneys today?
I write about that in the introduction to the book, and I'm going to read you a page. The central fact of our political and legal lives is the overwhelming power the corporate capitalist state has accumulated, especially since 9/11. In previous eras, during the time of fascist dictatorships, Antonio Gramsci wrote from his Italian prison cell that we need, quote, pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the heart. My friend Peter Weiss, a former vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, now in his mid-90s, added to Gramsci's resolve, denial is not an option. Despair is not an option. Resistance is the only option. You have to have hope, Ramsey Clark, also in his 90s, told me. Otherwise, you don't do anything. The attorneys whose lives and achievements are celebrated in this book have worked all their professional lives for the expansion of human rights as opposed to property rights. In so doing, they have worked for true democracy and the rule of law. But for me and many radical lawyers, there's another crucial step. Capitalism ultimately and increasingly is not compatible with democracy and the rule of law. Marx studied law. Both Castro and Lenin and Nelson Mandela were lawyers. For them and for me, there is one way out of the impending catastrophe, the ongoing ecocide, the heightened threat of nuclear annihilation, the crushing of democracy. And that is the building of a mass movement that will take political power to replace our current system with a genuine economic and political democracy. Imagine living in a socialist USA. This book is a compilation of profiles and interviews of radical lawyers. Most of them are from the 60s, my generation. As Lewis Lapham has observed, a person denied knowledge of its past cannot make sense of its present or imagine its future. These lawyers and activists that in one way or another participated in the essential struggles of their own times, they could sense the future in the instant, as Shakespeare said. And they understood that those who are above the struggle are also beside the point. To those lawyers and activists who are themselves deeply immersed in the political life of our stirring and difficult age, I hope this book will introduce new allies and fresh sources of strength.
Michael, I have a final question for you. As you know, the motto of the National Lawyers Guild, of which we're both longtime members, is, quote, justice is a constant struggle. Your thoughts?
Bill Kunstler used to say, there are no green pastures. Every generation has its own struggles. And we see the new generation today taking those struggles up, particularly with respect to the threat of nuclear war, the horrible threat of climate change, and the crushing restriction of democratic rights that we've had ever since 9/11.
Michael, congratulations on a truly important and very timely book.
Well, it's called Lawyers for the Left, in the courts, in the streets, and on the air, and you can get it online by going to orbooks.com. That's orbooks, orbooks.com. And if you push a button, they'll mail you the book.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In a rare and heartening victory for climate change activists, a Washington state appeals court recently overturned the conviction of a man who employed the so-called necessity defense. Activist Ken Ward said he had no alternative but to break into a pipeline facility to save the planet from global warming. While several lawyers and their clients have presented this strategy in court, it is rarely allowed to proceed. That's because in most courts, including federal appeals courts, protesters are unable to meet the threshold burden of showing that their actions were in reaction to an imminent threat. It's kind of like Fire Chief Steve McQueen blowing up a skyscraper's water tank to put out a fire in the film The Towering Inferno. But in his April 8th decision, Judge David Mann ruled that Ward, quote, reasonably believed the crimes he committed were necessary to minimize the harms that he perceived. Last year, Law and Disorder reported on how a Boston prosecutor reduced charges against 13 pipeline protesters who planned to mount a necessity defense, eliminating the possibility of trial. Even so, West Roxbury Judge Mary Ann Driscoll still found them not guilty by reason of necessity. In this Washington case, the Court of Appeals reversed the burglary conviction of Ken Ward, saying the trial court judge had violated Ward's Sixth Amendment rights by refusing to allow him to present the necessity defense to the jury. Joining us to talk about this remarkable ruling is Ted Hamilton, co-founder and staff attorney at the Climate Defense Center. Ted Hamilton, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ted, what was your reaction to the Court of Appeals ruling?
I was overwhelmed and overjoyed. It's great to see the court recognize Ken Ward's commitment to climate activism and the seriousness of his protest, to recognize that what Mr. Ward is fighting for is a real threat, and to recognize that courts need to start taking seriously the claims made by activists about the necessity of this sort of civil disobedience to protect the climate.
And given that this was such a singular and positive ruling, how do you describe the significance of the judge's ruling to the whole area of climate protest around the country?
Well, we've seen a rising wave of protest actions like Mr. Ward's at the pipeline to try to force policymakers to actually do something to address this impending crisis. And the judicial resistance to allowing protesters to speak in court has put a hamper on the ability of those activist campaigns to be heard publicly, and for there to be this sort of public ratification of the urgency behind these actions. So a decision like this, which follows one or two other recent decisions that have recognized the climate necessity defense, are really galvanizing for lots of activists. It kind of creates this sense that the political scene is shifting, that our institutions are shifting and starting to recognize that this is not some sort of fringe ideology, that in fact we all need to take this problem very seriously. And the fact that the court recognized that Mr. Ward's constitutional rights had been violated in this case, I think, is also very important, not just for climate protesters, but for dissent nationwide. We really need our activists to feel that what they are doing is legitimate and that it's protected under the Constitution. And so for a court to recognize, as I said, following up on some other recent decisions, that our constitutional rights are implicated in these civil disobedience cases is a very strong message to send both to the activist community and to the public.
Attorney Ted Hamilton, what kind of sentence did Ward face if the conviction stood?
Well, he was facing two felony charges for burglary and sabotage, and those charges had a maximum of 20 years in prison, as well as some pretty serious fines.
How many other valve turners have presented the same necessity defense?
So Mr. Ward was acting in coordination with activists in three other states, four other activists total, and all of them attempted to present a necessity defense with varying degrees of success. But that was part of their whole mission when they undertook this action, was to take their campaign into the courtroom and to try to use the necessity defense as a way to justify their actions, as a way to bring into the court system the urgency of climate protest. And since their action, there have actually been some other activists, especially around the Line 3 pipeline in Wisconsin and Minnesota, who have attempted a similar defense. And there's one group that listeners might be interested in called the Four Necessity Valve Turners in Minnesota, who undertook a very similar action and are also in the process of attempting a climate necessity defense right now.
Ted, let's talk about the so-called reasonable standard at issue. What did Ward have to show to prove necessity, and how did reasonableness factor into that?
So the necessity defense is something that exists in all jurisdictions in the United States, in many countries. Washington has its own version, as every state does, and it has four elements that any defendant needs to prove. They need to show that the defendant reasonably believed that the commission of their crime, that their actions were necessary to avoid some harm. The defendant needs to show that the harm that was avoided, the harm they were preventing, was less than the harm they caused through their actions. That the harm that they're trying to prevent was not brought about by themselves, and that they had no reasonable legal alternatives. So in this case, Ken Ward needed to show that, of course, he didn't cause climate change, that turning off a pipeline was a lesser harm than all the harms associated with climate change, and that there were no legal alternatives, that nothing besides civil disobedience was going to be as effective in addressing climate change, and that he reasonably believed that there was a connection between his protest and the avoidance of climate change. So the legal standard here was a preponderance of the evidence. Basically, Ken Ward had to convince the jury that it was more likely than not that the facts he was presenting did prove all those elements. And the reasonable belief element that you mentioned is something that doesn't exist in every state. Washington has it in their common law of necessity. And that basically just requires a defendant like Mr. Ward to convince the jury that he had a good faith assessment of the situation and really believed that what he was doing was going to be effective. Now, in the way that this case worked out itself, Ken Ward, of course, never got to actually present that evidence to the jury. The judge, prior to trial, decided that he didn't have sufficient evidence on all those elements. He decided that Ken Ward could not have had a reasonable belief in the effectiveness of his protest action. And it was those decisions by the judge rather than the jury that the appellate court last week reversed and said that those judge decisions had violated Mr. Ward's constitutional rights.
Tell us about Judge David Mann. What's his background?
Well, as I understand it, he's got a scientific background. I believe he was trained as a geophysicist or a geologist, and I know that during his legal career as a lawyer, he worked on some environmental issues. Now, I have no idea the degree to which his personality or his background might have informed his assessment of the climate science that was introduced in this case. And, you know, as lawyers, we can always guess what certain jurisdictions and certain judges might think about certain cases, especially when it comes to the ongoing, although somewhat drummed up controversy over the science of climate change. I think the really important issue here is that this case and the appeal that we were bringing on Mr. Ward's behalf really centered on constitutional rights and the right to protest. And so as much as the science of climate change and the public awareness of the ongoing catastrophe of climate change, as much as that's starting to affect the way judges are thinking about these issues, I believe, what's really central here is how we assess a defendant's right to make a case before the jury about what it is they were doing when they were trying to serve the public good.
Ted, what was the prosecution's argument?
Prosecution tried to attack Mr. Ward's necessity defense on a couple of different levels. On the one hand, we've seen this a lot in many cases, they took issue with Mr. Ward's assessment of global climate change, either calling into doubt the idea that climate change really is this kind of immediate, imminent threat, which of course we know it is. It's not only imminent, it's not only coming down the road, it's all around us. But the prosecution tried to cast some doubt on that, as well as arguing that no one individual, no one act of protest would really be effective in trying to address climate change. And that's the sort of argument we see all the time from many lawmakers, many judges. Even our Chief Justice John Roberts has made the argument that because climate change is such a global phenomenon, it affects everyone everywhere, there's really not much that any one person, even one country, can do about it. And so the prosecution's argument there is that this act of protest can't be effective. On another level, they were attacking the idea of the effectiveness or the advisability of civil disobedience overall. So they claimed that there are always legal alternatives to breaking the law. Mr. Ward has been an environmental activist for many, many years. He's tried everything he's supposed to. He's lobbied, he's petitioned. And of course, we know that the political system really has failed to address this climate crisis. And yet the prosecution wanted to see Mr. Ward keep trying those failed methods, and made the case that you never need to commit an act of civil disobedience in order to address something like this. Although, of course, the history of social change in the United States proves otherwise, that we actually do need courageous activists like Mr. Ward. We need movements like the climate justice movement to go outside the mainstream a bit and push the methods that we think of as reasonable political change in order to actually make differences at the policy level.
Ted, did the prosecutors claim the valve turners endanger public safety? And if so, how so?
Yes, so in Washington and in the other states in which the valve turners shut off the tar sands pipeline, prosecutors tried to argue that this was a reckless action, and that interfering with these private companies' pipelines posed a threat to the surrounding areas, with the idea that they might have caused some sort of oil spill. But our defendants put on expert witnesses who know these pipelines very intimately and actually showed that they had done their research. They knew exactly what they were doing when they went up to those pipelines and turned off the safety valves. In fact, they were doing what any pipeline technician would have done in a similar instance. And even before their actions, they called the pipeline companies to warn them that they were doing this act of protest, so that in the moment there was really no danger of to the public of any oil spill or otherwise. And in fact, the expert testimony that Mr. Ward was planning to put on trial would have shown that the real danger from these pipelines is them continuing to function. So the tar sands oil that flows through these pipelines is extremely dangerous to the climate, and the pipeline companies themselves have quite bad track records of ensuring the safety of their own pipeline. So actually, what's the safest thing to do with these pipelines is to turn them off.
Ted, speaking of civil disobedience, how do you think the new rash of so-called critical infrastructure bills might impact a CD?
Well, these critical infrastructure bills that are they're being introduced in states like North Dakota, Louisiana, many states where there's lots of energy infrastructure, they're basically laws designed by private industry, by the energy industry, and promoted by conservative lawmakers that impose special penalties on anyone who conducts an action like the valve turners, or in some instances even supports those actions, funds them, talks about them. And it's pretty clear that what the energy industry is doing here is trying to quell dissent. I think especially after the confrontation at Standing Rock, which the valve turners were acting in solidarity with, it really spooked the energy industry, and it really spooked their allies in state houses and in Washington. And so in the classic move of private industry and the state, they are trying to scare activists by saying you're going to face much more severe penalties if you mess with our private property. And they're using the rhetoric of national security and extremism to argue that these things are so essential to the national security of the United States that we have to protect them with special statutes that have very high consequences and threaten anyone who even wants to talk about these sorts of things. Now, it's very likely that these bills are unconstitutional because they do impinge on activist free speech, and they'll be challenged in courthouses. And so we might actually see the reaction of industry and conservative lawmakers against the valve turners as a measure of success. I mean, they wouldn't be reacting this way unless they were scared of how a public public opinion is shifting in response to these actions. So I take it actually as a great index of how successful these principled acts of civil disobedience are, because the industry is worried about their bottom line, and they're worried that this sort of principled action will create imitators and will inspire people to actually question why it is that we have these highly dangerous pipelines funneling highly dangerous fuels in our backyards, and maybe everyone should go and turn it off.
I think that's a critical point. When activists gain a measure of success, they're especially targeted by the authorities. Ted, if you don't mind a personal question, how did you get involved in this area, defending protesters?
I became pretty concerned about the issue of climate change several years ago. I think especially coming from a background in which I was not feeling the effects of the climate crisis, as a white male with the privilege of pursuing higher education, I can be somewhat protected from the effects of my lifestyle, of the lifestyle of many of my fellow Americans that are, you know, starting to have very serious effects on people around the world today and on future generations. So along with some friends, I felt a great need to try to do something to address that situation of deep injustice. And getting involved with the divestment movement as a student activist was really kind of the entree into this defense of activist work. So trying to convince our institutions to pull their public support of fossil fuel companies, I think, leads naturally to supporting movements around the country that are on the front lines and trying to confront the fossil fuel system. And as I mentioned earlier, it's not just a matter of trying to convince people about the facts of climate change. It's not just a matter of trying to keep fossil fuels in the ground, but we need to protect the right to protest. We need to protect dissent in the U.S., and that goes well beyond just the environmental movement or the climate justice movement. There are so many intersectional opportunities now for confronting structures of deep injustice and power that are preventing real change. And so ideas like the necessity defense can be applied not just in the climate context, but when it comes to resisting our immigration system or resisting racist policing. The ways in which we can work with climate activists to protect their protest rights can really have ramifying effects for broader social justice movements.
We have a few minutes remaining. What advice, Ted, do you have for activists or non-activists who want to get involved in protest or civil disobedience but are afraid of the possible penalties, especially with some of these new, really unconstitutional laws?
Well, of course, we have to recognize within the movement that there are people who are going to face far more adverse consequences as a result of being arrested because of the racial and gender nature of policing in this country and our court system. It is not easy for everyone to decide that they want to go out and voluntarily submit themselves to the criminal legal system. So it's always a personal question. It always requires kind of open and honest conversations with your fellow activists to decide who should be taking this sort of action and how advisable it is. Now, the more that people do take on actions like this, the easier it is for everybody, really. So there is this blowback in terms of increased repression of dissent. But I think what the decision we got last week shows, with a court recognizing that there is a right to present evidence, at least, of the advisability of this sort of action, what that shows is that the more we see this, the more it's kind of presented to the mainstream and gets favorable press or starts to seep into the public consciousness as something that's rational, the easier it makes it for everybody to take those risks, and hopefully the less serious those risks will become. It's not always going to be an easy road. There's always going to be some blowback, but if we just think back on how favorably everybody views the civil rights movement, I believe now, that was considered a radical wave of lawbreaking in its time, but with a critical mass of people taking it upon themselves and supporting each other and giving people the strength to know that no matter the personal consequences they face, there'll be people there taking care of them and supporting them through the whole process. As that continues, this becomes something that will come to be seen as, you know, the status quo or what we should have been doing years ago, and not the actions of kind of the radical few who are showing us the way right now.
I totally agree. There are strength in numbers. We're going in the right direction here. You know, if enough people take to the streets, they don't need a permit. If enough people disrupt these pipelines, they're not going to be prosecuted. They can't have a trial of 500 people.
So, absolutely.
I wanted to get your reaction to another point. It's not like the powers that be don't understand that climate change is a threat to humanity. They understand that. Trump may say that it's a Chinese hoax, but he doesn't believe that. He just spent a lot of money building a 2,000-foot long wall in Ireland to protect his golf course from encroaching sea levels. So they know what's going on. And how do you explain that paradox that these people who know what's going on will nonetheless continue to march humanity over a cliff?
Well, I think there might just be, unfortunately, a self-serving calculus that you demonstrated with that great example of Trump's seawall. The powers that be know that the more time they buy making profits off of fossil fuels, the more time they have to build their fortresses and defend themselves from the inevitable natural and social consequences of climate change. And so I agree that climate denial is not really a matter of real intellectual disagreement for most people. It's a matter of preventing the systemic changes that, of course, are going to happen, and ensuring that we can, that the elite will get as much surplus value off the rest of us as they can before that moment of crisis strikes. And by that point, who knows what the future will look like for the rest of us. So I think there are a lot of ways in which people can convince themselves that this is not a crisis we need to address in the moment, that we always have more time. Of course, the millions and billions of people who are really severely feeling the consequences of climate change already know that that's not the case. But the more you can kind of stick your finger in the dike and prevent the evidence of the impending catastrophe from coming, the longer we can pretend that the status quo can keep burning off of the same fumes and fuels that we're living off of now. And that's the whole point of the climate justice movement, is to show the ridiculousness of that situation and to try to make what really is the reality of climate change evident in our policymaking circles. And we have to change that equation so that it's no longer profitable, it's no longer worth it for the powers that be or for the elite to prevent action. They have to realize that their power is slipping away, and that waiting any longer is actually going to come at a price to their interests and not just the interests of everybody below them.
Attorney Ted Hamilton, we're running out of our allotted time, both for this interview and I think for humanity, actually. But I wanted to ask you one final question, and that's, what kind of systemic changes do you think we need to do, and do in a hurry, to make things livable for this planet?
Well, I would just lift up the voices of the climate justice movement, who have been really pressing the case recently and quite convincingly that this can't just be a matter of regulating CO2 emissions. We need to change the way we think about social value and move much of our regulation of energy and our regulation of work in this country out of a purely vicious market economy and start to do some real reforms that allow us to, yes, transition to renewable energy, but also have an economy and a society that's built on a different way of thinking about our relationship to nature and to each other. And as a first step, I think something like the Green New Deal is a very good way to think about things differently. So not just regulating smokestacks, but making sure that people have the health care and the jobs that they need in order to thrive in the next energy economy. And so I would just look to the really powerful and well thought out and rigorous ideas that the climate justice movement and the democratic socialists and the left in general in the United States and around the world are promoting. I think there's actually a relatively clear path ahead of us, but it does involve not just policy changes, it really involves reorientations in the way we think about our place on the planet and in society.
Ted, how can our listeners learn more about your work at the Climate Defense Center?
Well, please go to climatedefenseproject.org. We've got updates about our cases there. We have a climate necessity case guide that lists all the attempted climate necessity defenses in recent years. You can check out the case I mentioned, the four necessity valve turners. There's a page on our website where you can donate to their legal defense fund and just keep following the legal and activist news from this side of the climate movement.
Ted Hamilton, thank you so much for a wonderful interview and best of luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you take it easy, Ted. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.